session number 23848, reel 2.
Mr. Wild Gust, reel 2. Right, Mr. Wild Gust, we're talking still about the pre-war period. I'd like to just take us back to the Munich Agreement and what you remember about that and how that affected you and your friends and your father.
I don't know, up to a point it didn't really affect it at all. I didn't see the significance at the time. I think everyone was relieved that there wasn't going to be a war, but it was on the cards that there would be. It was only a sort of a temporary thing. I remember, of course, the dishing out of the gas masks and going to local schools to get gas masks and to register for various things, respirators and the rest of it. And of course, when I was in 1939, after I started work, when it was getting a bit more dicey, I was involved in that myself, of people coming and collecting their gas masks and so on. But politically, it sort of washed over me. I remember the film at the time was Cavalcade, Noel Coward's Cavalcade, and of course, I think these people wrote things after the event, and were wise after the event, and of course he had his characters who said that Munich was terrible, it should never have happened, and they should have sorted Hitler out much earlier, which they probably should have done. But I think if they had done, I don't think the whole world would have changed at all. I think we should have just finished up. With hindsight, I think we should have just finished up. With hindsight, I think we should have just finished up in a country behind the times that wouldn't advance at all.
What did your dad think about the Munich Agreement? Do you remember anything about his reactions?
I can't remember him being particularly influenced one way or the other. He probably was to his friend. I mean, I only saw him at the most once a week, and we'd go to the cinema, and that was about all, and have a meal. But
What kind of films would you go and see?
Well, it was usually left to us to choose. I mean, it was they were invariably the adventure type of things. But I do remember once going to this film which featured Lenin and Russia, and he was most tasty. I never realised that this was going to be on, so he was rather pleased that we'd happened to choose a film that was interested him as well. But he was quite everybody was a cinema fan in those days. He didn't go three times a week. You were lacking.
Did you pay much attention to the newsreel part of the programme?
Yes, well, it was all part of the programme, wasn't it? I mean, there was a cinema in Nottingham, the Hippodrome, and if you went on a Monday, they used to run films to test the time to see what they could fit in, and sometimes you got as many as two feature films and about four other short ones. And of course, being a continuous programme, you could stay there all day if you wanted to. But I always used to go to one the day before I went back to school, which cost tuppence. The Goldsmiths Theatre, which became the Nottingham Playhouse eventually. Still there, but it's a pub now, I think. But I've even got a list of all those films I went to in this diary of mine, and how much I paid. And I think it averaged out about three times a week.
And what was your preference? Was it for British films or American films?
Didn't worry me at all. American, I think. I mean, they were the best. Well, you're brought up to it. I mean, you didn't really bother.
Did you look at the stars of these films as kind of role models in terms of how they dressed and how they acted? Was there anything
like that? I remember saying to one of my sons, we were talking about contemporary things, and he said, well, your films would have affected you. And I said, no, they didn't. And on reflection, I realised, of course, they did, because when you came out of a cinema sort of walking like John Wayne, and you smoked cigarettes like these actors did, and you did take certain characteristics of them home with you. Even probably the way you talked in many instances. Yes, it was...
So it was a major hobby at this period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What were your other hobbies? That,
I can't remember. Oh, cycling and walking. I suppose, we, like everybody, you did stamp collecting, but I can't say I had... swimming, you know, sport generally, but nothing in particular. But the other thing that's noticeable, of course, now compared with today, is that in those days, the only clothes you had were the clothes you wore. So when you went out walking in the country or the seaside, you still wore exactly the same things. If you're lucky, you might have a pair of sandals. But, well, you only have to look at old photographs now, you see men sitting at the seaside with the collar and tie and waistcoats and bowler hats on. and it was the same with us. And I remember my going on the hole of my sole came off my shoe, but he just sort of stuck it back and sort of hoped it would stay on while he were walking. But cycling, I mean, when you got a cycle, that was a great day. And I used to spend a lot of time cycling in Derbyshire and all around.
And what about bad habits like drinking and smoking and cards?
Well, I remember the first time I ever smoked, I was about three. And I was behind a sofa with my sister, who was about six at the time, and she'd found a box of cigarettes. I think they were... And because she couldn't count at the time, to share them out, she cut them all in half, and we had lots of halves each until we were caught. But my father smoked very heavily, and of course we encouraged him, because in those days they had cigarette cards. And it was not looked upon as a stigma at all. And I remember one of my his uncle, or a friend who I looked upon as an uncle because he was a bit older than me, and he gave me a pipe and said, well, make you sick if he kills you. I was about six at the time, and I puffed at this pipe, and it didn't really have any effect at all. But I smoked, I think I gave it up between the ages of 16 and 18. I've forgotten. I smoked regularly. Not when I was at school, but after I was at school, and I had a puff occasionally at home, because my mother always took the view it's far better to have it at home than to have it outside. But I remember we were talking about it with friends the other day, in the days when we had cigarette machines outside shops and on railings. Nowadays, if they put a cigarette machine outside, it would have gone within 5 minutes. But we used to leave home and get a tuppenny packet of Woodbines from this machine, and then walk to this area in Lamley and smoke them. We'd always make sure we broke the other one in half. If there were five, we'd have two and a half each. As part of the sort of ritual, then we'd go home, and that was the end of it. Drinking, I didn't really start drinking until I was about 18. Yes, I think 18. You couldn't afford it almost. I remember at my first job, we worked on Saturday morning, and at the dinner time, some of the older ones went out to the pub, and I joined them, and beer was sixpence a pint. But as I only got 4 and 6 a week pocket money, because I got £1 a week less whatever they took off you, and my mother gave me 4 and 6. And that was it. So it didn't go very far. But I suppose relatively it went a reasonable way, because, as I say, beer was sixpence and cigarettes were ten for sixpence.
Now, you mentioned that in your job you got involved with civil defence, with the gas mask. Could you just describe what that entailed, what you were doing?
Well, we just used to go to... a local school and sit behind a counter with a pile of gas masks, and then people would come in and sign for them, and you'd give them, and that was it.
I mean,
it was
what did you think about that at the time? Did you think this was going to be a valuable, a major thing that you would need, or did people regard it as a joke? I mean, what was people's attitude?
Well, everybody thought it was going to be necessary, but hoped it wouldn't be. But I think the main problem was that people objected to having the ordinary little rubber gas masks when civil defence and policemen had these decent ones with, you know, with a proper face mask and a satchel to carry it in, whereas we had to, the common folk had to carry them around in cardboard boxes and with a bit of string on.
So it was a better gas mask?
It was, yeah, looked better. far better looking thing. Well, it's the same, the army issue. I mean,
well, did it work better, do you think? Was it more comfortable to wear? Or?
Yeah.
So people would complain about that?
Well, yes, well, not out of it. I mean, they were pleased to get what they were getting, but when they realised what they had got, they were sort of very ordinary thing.
Now, you mentioned your father's socialist sympathies. Was that reflected at all? I'm going to ask you about, you know, the day that war was declared, but just before that, there was the Russian-German non-aggression pact. Can you remember him having any ideas about that, you know, when the Russians and the Germans aligned for a while?
I can't remember him specifically mentioning it. I don't, as far as I was concerned, I didn't really see what anybody was worrying about. I didn't see the implications of what was going on. I do now, of course, and I did when the war broke out, but it didn't. My father's view was whatever Russia did was right, and there was a good reason for it, you know. So that's about all he can say, you know. It's his country, right or wrong, Russia.
Did he ever talk about Stalin?
Well, yes, of course, he was a fine man. they would, later on, of course, in the war, they would never take Moscow. They would never take Moscow because of Russia. And, of course, when they came into the war, he was more interested in the war then. It was became a...
What did he think of Chamberlain? Your father.
Nobody thought much about Chamberlain at all. I think he was probably a bit maligned, but he was a bit hopeless. I don't think he quite. We were all disappointed, I suppose, in his attitude. But there again, there was a certain sense of relief also.
And what do you remember about the actual day that war was declared?
Well, I remember my mother calling upstairs and saying the Prime Minister was going to be on the radio and listen to it, as we've heard so many times before. And I remember her crying, and I thought, that's strange that she'd cry in this. And of course, it was only 21 years since the war had ended. And now, 21 years, when you look back, you think, good grief, you know, what a short time it was. And, of course, when the First War, well, she was born in 1886, so she was 28 when the First World War broke out, and as far as I know, although she had two brothers who served, neither of them were wounded or killed, and I think the war, from that angle, from the family angle, sort of was a relief. But of course, we hadn't, I suppose to some degree she was worried with having a family of her own, and of course nobody quite knew what was going to happen. And of course when the first air raid siren went that night, and everybody got up and wondered what the heck was going to happen, well, in the night, I can't remember, it was the night of the day. But there was a certain amount of apprehension, but I think by the next morning, apart from the Athenia being sunk, when everybody realised we probably were at war, it was going to be rather on the model of the First World War, and we should all finish up in trenches.
Now, at this stage, you've mentioned earlier about, you know, trying to join the Navy, and so on. Was there any moving through this period from late 1939 to 1940? Were there any local incidents that stand out that affected you and the job that you were doing and so on?
You mean early 39 to the outbreak of war? I remember we had to... They were doing this wonderful thing called microfilming. and all the books and ledgers and things were being put onto microfilm, which nobody quite understood what it was. And they said, well, we're taking lots of photographs and they're all being stored. I had to go to what are known as the Peel Street Caves in Nottingham, which were underground. It was an underground sandstone quarry which was converted into air raid shelters. I remember going there for some reason or other. I used to go and pay this guy in the car with a superior to pay the workmen on various projects throughout the city. But apart from this sort of general taking steps in case a war broke out, nothing of great interest. I was not very keen on my job. I was stuck in an office all the time doing very routine jobs, sort of like sticking on stamps. And also, of course, one was expected to study. And what you studied was bookkeeping and general accountancy. For what was known as the IMTA, the Institute of Treasurers and Municipal Accountants, I believe was the thing. So he had to go to night school, and that didn't please me particularly, because I didn't like what he was taking. And to some extent, as soon as the war broke out, I began to think that it might be an excuse to get away from it all. But the city of Nottingham took a very jaundiced view of volunteers. A friend of mine who worked in the same office, they're called Cliff Lane, a volunteer for the Navy, and he was told that if he joined up he would not get his job back after the war and that it was up to him. Of course this was frowned upon later, and in fact Nottingham City were blacklisted for many years. They never paid any employee anything until towards the end of the war. They made a slight contribution, I believe, to married men. But he was the first one who did volunteer, and he was brought before the assistant treasurer and told very strongly that if you want to do this sort of thing, it's up to you to do it yourself. And
why did they have that attitude? Was it explained at the time, or...?
No, it was. I think it was against national policy, if there was a policy in those days. I don't think there was. You know, they took the attitude, you're bloody lucky to have a job with us, you know. It's a very important job to work for a municipal accountant. So. Going forward a lot of years, I mean, to sort of finish that off, when I came out of the army, I had to pay my superannuation payments for the whole of my army service, which just about took away my whatever they call it when I came out of the army. I forgot what they call it now. When he came out of the army, they gave you some cash.
Gratuity,
that's right. But they made me pay my superannuation for all the years I've been in the army. So they were a jolly decent lot, you know. I think they did send us a odd book, but they weren't very good to serving.
And just again moving forward a little bit, compared to your future comrades, they were treated, do you think, better for either?
Oh yes, well they had to. I mean, when I joined up, which was October 1940, they'd had to change their opinion because, of course, by that time Dunkirk and.
On Dunkirk. So you're still working in this job. You're in the Nottingham area. You got the pictures regularly, watching the newsreels. Suddenly, there's this major disaster with the retreat of the British Army. How did that affect people? How did that affect you and your friends? That, I mean, how would you put the question another way? How did you feel that the war was gone prior to Dunkirk when people talked
about it? Well, from the outbreak of war, I mean, nobody could quite understand why there was no particular action. And they reported even the sinking of ships. I mean, I've got a whole list. I kept a list of all the ships that were sunk until eventually, of course, they realised that it was a very bad propaganda. And they stopped publishing. They just wouldn't put a couple of lines in saying a ship had been sunk. But it was... Well, I mean, it's now called a phony war, and that's what it seemed to be. I had a friend who joined, he volunteered for the South Knots Hussars prior to his being called up, because they said if you join the Territorial Army, when you have done your national conscription, that time will be taken off the time after you've done your conscription. So he joined up with that intention. Of course, he got called up the first day of the war, in fact, just before the war. And I remember him coming down Mansfield Road marching from the church after going to the service on the day war broke out, and making rude remarks to him as he went by. But anyway...
What was he called?
A fellow called Noel Selby. Mm. And Noel was quite a lad. He died... Well, some years ago now, 20-odd years ago, but he was, I lost my track. He came on leave, of course. Christmas was 39, and resplendent in his uniform, and I found that, of course, life was much better when you're in uniform in those days, because everybody, all the girls followed you around, and... we just sort of carried on, and normally it was a very bad winter, if I remember. It snowed like hell, and he wrote letters from various camps in England, and he had to put things like somewhere in England. I mean, you weren't allowed to say where you were, and it was all very hush hush. But of course, eventually we were bound to win. I mean, there was no question about that. But everybody wondered what the heck was happening. And come Dunkirk, again, all this I've got written in my diary at the time, when we were quite relieved when it was... I think there was a great relief that we had no longer to worry about any more allies. And that at least now we knew where we stood. And that... we're obliged to win. I mean, if we were by ourselves and didn't have to worry about the French and all the rest of the lot, I suppose Italy coming into war was a bit of a blow. But there was never any, and I remember, feeling of panic whatsoever at all. It was assumed that eventually we would do it. And of course, then what happened was that they decided. The funny thing, though, going back again, is that. One of the suburbs, not even, of course, in Dunkirk. And we had a friend, she was older than us at the time, who drove an ambulance or helped to in civil defence in various ways. And she went down to Dunkirk, came back and said, but there aren't any soldiers down there at all. And she thought they were all coming back through Dunkirk and not him. And it was beyond her comprehension that there was no one there. However, that's a side thing. But they then decided on the radio to form the local defence volunteers, the LDV. And they would take men of, I think it was 18 to something or other. So I went down with the intention of joining the LDV. And I went to the recruiting office and... they said, how old are you? I was 17 at the time. It would be about June 1940. And of course, instead of walking around the block and going back again and then telling I was 18, I was very honest. And they said, well, come back when you're 18 and you can join the proper army. And then they changed the LDV to the Home Guard, and by this time I sort of got the idea of joining the army in my mind, and but I hadn't any idea of what I would have liked to have gone into in the army. I think it never occurred to me that there were various branches of it. Some were more rigorous than others. I had two friends in the artillery, and one day stuck on their cap badge. And when eventually I became 18, I was 18 in August, and I don't know why I left it a month, but I duly presented myself at London Road recruiting office, and they said, "Will you be in the Sherwood Forestry?" And I thought, "Well, that's all right." You know. But it had never occurred to me that I was in the infantry of the line, because all soldiers were infantrymen as far as I was concerned. I mean, and of course it's the only arm where you've got real soldiers, quite honestly, so we say. But, and it was the young soldier, 70 battalion, young soldier battalion, which I didn't know anything about that at the time. Yeah. Anyway, I signed and they said, "Come back on Monday." And I don't think they ever gave us a shilling, but we were signed on at 2 shillings a day, which to me, of course, meant I got far more money than I had when I was working. And 14 shillings a week, your next of kin got 7 shillings, whether you like it or not, which went to her mother. And so I had 7 shillings a week instead of 4 and 6 pence.
Now, before we talk about, you know, your introduction to the army in the 70th Young Soldiers Battalion, you mentioned you got the idea of joining the army. Now, where did that idea come from, and what attracted you to the army?
I don't know, really. Quite honestly, I don't know. I suppose it was an ingrained thought that when you joined the armed services, and I know I should have thought about the name, that the army was where you went, and the army was what fought battles. And I never thought of looking for a cushy job, sort of thing. I just assumed that you would be in the infantry, whether you liked it or not. And it was quite an honourable thing to do, to be a soldier in that sense.
What did your father think?
He made no. My opinion, as far as I remember. I mean, I didn't even bother to tell him. My mother took it very well, which, looking back, I think was quite good. She never queried it. I suppose she was a bit worried. But I just said, "I'm going to join the army," and that was it. I sort of went and did it. And I don't know really why I did do it, apart from how the fact is that they wanted volunteers and they needed them, and it also got me out of my job as well, which was a very boring life. But now that was the main reason.